This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. Calculated risk. Brian Krug is a gentlemanly loan shark. He lends to businesses that are desperate for cash. This was written by William Baldwin from Forbes magazine. What's Elon Musk's credit score? It can't be good. Tapped out, he ran up a tab to buy Twitter. The floating interest rate he's paying is 10.4%. That's more than what Donald Trump considers a tolerable interest rate on credit cards. Musk is the richest person in the solar system, and yet X Corporation, as the company is now styled, is paying through the nose for a loan. Understanding this paradox is the job of Brian C. Krug, evaluator extraordinaire of creditworthiness. Krug runs the Artisan Partners High Income Fund, a collection of junk bonds and syndicated bank loans from 133 somewhat sketchy companies. His aim? To buy paper that looks worse than it is. X debt is in the collection. By conventional measures, corporate debt looks bad if the ratio of operating income to interest is low. The other tell is a high ratio of debt to equity. This is the same way you are judged on a mortgage application. The bank compares your income to your mortgage payments and the loan balance to your equity. What are the numbers for X, a private corporation? Krug joined an invitation-only top-secret review, personally orchestrated by Musk, of the company's financial statements. Whatever they were, they obliged Musk to offer a very stiff coupon. But they didn't stop Krug. And to go with the flow of conventional measures means to end up with a conventional return. Krug aims to do better than that. His angle? Put aside the numbers and think about the prospects for the business. On this score, Krug gives X a lot of credit. He is an avid user of the platform, following 648 contributors, and sees the arc of news gathering bending in X's direction. And then there's Musk. Says Krug, quote, Elon has a strong history of taking companies and doing great things with them, close quote. Krug has a strong history of avoiding deadbeats. The usual strategy in lending to weak borrowers is to reach for yield and pray that the coupons will be high enough to offset any damage from defaults. Thus, over the not quite 12 years since Krug opened Artisan High Income, the passively managed State Street SPDR Bloomberg Junk Fund has collected a lot of interest, but given some of that back with a 20.5% erosion of principal. In the same period, Krug's fund has seen only 1.5% shrinkage. The Artisan Fund enjoys the same fat yields, between 6 and 7%, that you see in the index. The result? Over its history, Krug's fund has averaged a 6.5% annual return on the institutional share class, 1.5 percentage points ahead of the index. This is not the consequence of any winning streak, such as a lucky bet on the yield curve. Krug plods ahead by making slightly better credit judgments than other fund managers over and over. Morningstar has him beating the average of his junk fund peers in each of the 11 full calendar years of the fund's existence. Krug makes quite the contrast with the swashbuckler running X. Diffident and soft-spoken, he won't say anything bad about the losers that he turns away, but he does talk up the winners. He likes cruise lines. 6 years ago, COVID crushed the industry. Carnival Corporation was losing $800 million a month, keeping its empty ships afloat. Krug's funds stepped in with rescue financing and collected some nice coupons. He's still lending at lower rates, but if Carnival gets any stronger, it won't be long in a junk fund. Krug says he's not likely to be a provider when data center builders come to Wall Street begging for $100 billion of capital. But he does like the equipment vendor's prospects. The fund holds bonds of Kioxia, a supplier of memory. That's not a household name. Krug read about it in a Next post. Intertape Polymer Group debt is a holding at Artisan. Numbers, a bit scary, with a lot of leverage dating to a private equity buyout. Coupons, as high as 10%. Prospects, good. This company makes the tape that closes Amazon boxes. Krug makes some bad bets, such as an Optimum Communications part of the French Altice cable empire, offsetting the damage to principal from clunkers like this one, capital gains when bonds bought at distressed prices are redeemed or traded away at close to par. Says Krug, quote, "The whole portfolio is up for sale," close quote. Krug, who is 49 years old, has been a credit watcher for almost all his adult life. After earning a finance degree from Miami University of Ohio, he joined Waddell & Reed, long past its days of glory, as a mutual fund pioneer. He eventually landed the job of managing its Ivy High Income Fund. It is quite the challenge to bring excitement to a fixed income portfolio managed in a suburb of Kansas City. Krug delivered enough sizzle to bring in $10 billion of assets. It was time to take a risk. At age 37, he quit. Artisan Partners is headquartered in Milwaukee, but its money management stars work wherever they want and hire whomever they want. It's a bunch of feudal lords raising their own armies and allowing a faraway king to handle the back office work. Artisan offered him lower pay than he was getting at the Ivy Fund. In 2014, it staked him to $10 million of seed capital and told him to do his thing. In due time, Krug fled Kansas, setting up shop in Denver, where it's easier to recruit hotshot analysts and traders. Repeating his asset-gathering feat, he presides over $15 billion now. He probably is, and certainly deserves to be, pocketing a handsome piece of maybe $100 million a year in fees. Most of the money is in the original bond fund, now closed to new customers, but you can still get into the newer Artisan Floating Rate Fund. If you are fearful of interest rate risk, this is the place to be. That leaves risk to principal. Krug reflects on floaters from First Brands that he was looking at last year. They had a tempting double-digit yield. He took a pass. That debt is now trading at less than a penny on the dollar. Quote, 11% is great, except if you lose 99% of your money, close quote, Krug says. This fate could befall X, but nothing ventured, nothing gained. Here's a final thought. Quote, everything we get outside of the free gifts of nature must in some way be paid for. That's from Henry Hazlitt. And here's a sidebar, How to Play It by William Baldwin. Three rules for buying corporate bonds. First, pay attention to duration, rate risk, and credit quality, not yield. Next, don't own junk except in a tax-favored account. Finally, don't buy individual securities as opposed to a fund, unless you're investing at least $50 million. With that in mind, consider the exchange-traded products labeled State Street SPDR Portfolio High Yield and X-Trackers USD High Yield Corporate. They both run up expenses of 0.05% annually, have average credit quality somewhere between single B and double B, and have durations in the neighborhood of 3 years. For an open-ended fund, get Vanguard High Yield Corporate with similar risk parameters and a 0.12% expense ratio on purchases over $50,000. William Baldwin is Forbes Investment Strategies columnist. Here's a commentary from Steve Forbes, editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. Ode to NATO. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, gets no respect these days. You'd never know from all the drama over Greenland and because NATO is a favorite punching bag of President Trump's that this extraordinarily successful defensive alliance remains essential to U.S. security and a safer world. Letting NATO fall apart would be a historic disaster that could lead to a third world war. NATO, with U.S. leadership, was founded in 1949 to counter the threat to Western Europe from the Soviet Union. Its core tenet was basic. An attack on one member would be considered an attack on all. Moscow could forget trying to divide the U.S. and Europe or play one Western European country against another, this at a time when France and Italy had powerful communist parties. The alliance's purpose was pungently put by its first secretary general, quote, keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down, close quote. NATO worked. Moscow lost the 40-year Cold War. However, the end of the Cold War didn't mean the end of NATO. both the Central and Eastern European countries like Poland that had been under the Kremlin's yoke, as well as the newly independent nations of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia that emerged from the rubble of the Soviet Empire, had no illusions that their freedom was ensured. Nor did the countries that became independent with the collapse of communist Yugoslavia. These countries all realized that retrograde forces could well emerge in Russia, which is why they wanted membership in NATO. As we've witnessed with Vladimir Putin's murderous moves, those fears of Russian aggression weren't unfounded, and were indeed the reason both Sweden and Finland abandoned their neutrality and joined NATO. NATO is key to keeping Putin's imperial ambitions at bay. More profoundly, the security provided by NATO and the increasing economic integration of Europe, exemplified by the EU, has made war between Germany and France inconceivable. Europe is no longer a cauldron of power politics. But now a mortal danger is lurking. The withering of NATO would mean that countries would have to look out for themselves, as they did before the last century's two world wars. Nations in Asia and the Middle East would also realize that the U.S. could no longer be relied upon to help counter the imperial ambitions of China, Russia, and even North Korea. This everyone-for-themselves system guarantees big trouble, as it did for times immemorial prior to World War II. Before President Trump's first term, most NATO members, including the U.S., recklessly allowed their militaries to atrophy. Now all are awake to the dangers out there. Positive U.S. leadership with NATO is crucial for a better world. Continuing in the commentary section, enduring excellence. In a world increasingly defined by the fleeting and the disposable, true permanence has become one of the rarest forms of luxury. Products are designed to be replaced, institutions lose sight of their founding purpose, and too many businesses sacrifice long-term value for short-term applause. Against this backdrop, high in the Rockies, stands a remarkable rebuke to modern impermanence. The Broadmoor, a 107-year-old American institution that demonstrates what enduring excellence looks like when stewardship triumphs over fashion. From the moment one arrives, the Broadmoor conveys a seriousness of purpose. The architecture is elegant but disciplined. The grounds expansive yet orderly. A still lake anchors the property, while Cheyenne Mountain and the Rockies rise quietly behind it, creating an atmosphere that encourages reflection rather than distraction. This is the result of long-term thinking applied with uncommon consistency, precisely the mindset that distinguishes enduring enterprises from transient successes. I've stayed many times at the resort with unadulterated pleasure, and Forbes magazine has held corporate events there that have invariably met our high expectations. Since opening its doors in 1918, the Broadmoor has embraced a timeless formula: classic design, impeccable service, and an unwavering belief that hospitality is both an art and a calling. What makes the commitment especially notable today is its governance. A unique 100-year trust safeguards the resort's legacy, ensuring that its standards, culture, and traditions are protected with the same care that a museum gives its greatest works. In an era of corporate churn and financial engineering, this kind of far-sighted stewardship is not just rare, it's invaluable. The results speak for themselves. The Broadmoor is the longest-running Forbes 5-star and AAA 5-diamond resort in the world, earning both distinctions every year since their inception. Consistency at this level is never an accident, but the product of disciplined reinvestment, operational rigor, and a refusal to compromise on fundamentals. The scale of the property reinforces this philosophy. Spanning roughly 5,000 acres, the Broadmoor unfurls like a great American estate. Nearly 800 rooms and suites, cottages, brownstones, and an estate house offer a range of experiences, each shaped by the historic sensibility that defines the resort. The grounds were designed in 1917-1918 by the visionary and legendary Olmsted brothers and radiate a sense of intentionality. Accommodations favor comfort and continuity over ostentation. Interiors are warm, refined, and quietly confident. Modern technology is present, but never intrusive. This balance explains why the Broadmoor has long attracted not only families and leisure travelers, but also executives and leaders seeking clarity away from constant interruption. Dining follows the same disciplined approach. Across the resort's restaurants, The emphasis is on quality, execution, and civility. Meals unfold at a human pace, encouraging conversation and connection. Whether at a working breakfast or a long evening dinner, the table becomes a place where relationships deepen and ideas are exchanged, an underrated asset in both hospitality and business. The Estate House, a 12,000-square-foot mansion with 5 suites, 7 baths, and 2 croquet lawns, feels lifted from another era. One half expects Henry James to stroll in with a notebook. The Forbes 5-star spa, which spans 40,000 square feet and offers 36 treatment rooms, pools, and quiet spaces, demonstrates that wellness, when done properly, is not a fad but a tradition. Recreation, too, is integrated thoughtfully. Championship golf courses, fly fishing, hiking, tennis, falconry, and access to 7 falls complement the broader experience. The Broadmoor Manitou and Pikes Peak Cog Railway, one of only 2 cog railways in the U.S. and the highest in the nation, carries guests to the summit of Pikes Peak in heated cars, equal parts engineering achievement and patriotic pilgrimage. It reminds visitors of America's historic confidence in tackling big challenges. Yet the Broadmoor's most enduring asset isn't its acreage or amenities, but its people. Among the resort's 2,000-plus staff members reside thousands of collective years of service. The staff serves guests whose families have returned for 7 or 8 generations. This depth of institutional memory, so often dismissed in modern management, is one of the resort's greatest competitive advantages. Supporting that culture is Broadmoor University, the resort's in-house training academy. At a time when cost-cutting often masquerades as strategy, the Broadmoor invests in craftsmanship and understands that people, properly trained and respected, aren't an expense but an asset. Many American businesses would do well to relearn this lesson. Perhaps the most subtle luxury the Broadmoor offers is its respect for unstructured time. Sitting by the lake, walking the grounds, or simply observing the rhythm of the property feels restorative rather than idle. What ultimately sets the Broadmoor apart isn't beauty alone, but philosophy. It stands as a reminder that America's greatest economic and cultural achievements were built by institutions willing to think in centuries, not in fiscal years. The Broadmoor offers something profoundly reassuring, proof that excellence endures when we choose to build for the long run. Here's another article from Forbes, Inside Charlemagne's Empire. Radio personality Charlemagne the God signed a $200 million deal with iHeartMedia. Now he has ambitious plans to turn his Black Effect network into the BET of podcasting. On a chilly night in November, radio personality Charlemagne the God is roaming through the aisles of Midtown Comics in New York City, captivated by the heroes and villains that shaped his childhood. Quote, escapism at the highest level, close quote, he says. Quote, everybody's here for a purpose, close quote. Dressed in a black pea coat, white hoodie, black jeans, and tan Timberland boots, this isn't the media vigilante that listeners of The Breakfast Club have come to expect over the past 15 years. The 47-year-old comic book nerd, leafing through original graphic novels of Batman, Superman, Wolverine, and one of his favorites, Luke Cage, is more subdued and introspective as he considers his public and private personas. Quote, I'm like Smart Hulk, close quote, Charlemagne says. Quote, when Bruce Banner learns how to combine himself with the Incredible Hulk, he's Smart Hulk. I'm Leonard McKelvey, close quote, he adds, using his real name, emphasizing the second syllable of his first name. Charlemagne is now an extension of that, close quote. But Charlemagne is the name the world has come to know over the past few decades, beginning as a radio intern at Z93 in Charleston, South Carolina, and continuing through his time with radio host Wendy Williams before joining the syndicated Breakfast Club show in 2010 alongside DJ Envy and Angela Yee. Across more than 100 stations on the iHeartMedia network, he can be equal parts trash talker, voice for the voiceless, and advocate for mental health, a balance, as he likes to say, of quote-unquote ratchetness and righteousness. In other words, he's not afraid to go there. Charlemagne has railed against corporate DEI, calling it, quote, well-intentioned, but mostly garbage, close quote. And among the celebrities who have been named Donkey of the Day on The Breakfast Club are Diddy, con artist, Nicki Minaj, stank and nasty, and Post Malone, not my cup of mayonnaise, all in quotes. He's also an equal opportunity offender when it comes to politics. After House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries referred to him as Charlatan the Fraud, he responded by taunting Jeffries as quote-unquote Chuck E. Cheese Obama. He also frequently calls President Trump a fascist, which led the insulter-in-chief to refer to Charlemagne as a racist sleazebag, close quote. Quote, no fear, close quote, says John Stewart of Charlemagne, who has been a guest on The Daily Show for years and has guest-hosted. Quote, he has an incredible ability to distill conversation to its salient center, and it's not a contrivance for clicks, it's real, close quote. Adds Bob Pittman, chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia, quote, does he say stuff that a lot of people don't agree with? Of course, but that's Charlemagne being true to Charlemagne, close quote. He has been consistently rewarded for that outrageousness. Last year, Charlemagne signed a 5-year, $200 million extension with iHeartMedia. The deal puts him in the same league with Joe Rogan, who signed a multi-year extension with Spotify for a reported $250 million in 2024. Locking in Charlemagne is vital to iHeartMedia, which struck a deal with Netflix to stream The Breakfast Club, among more than 15 other podcasts, in 2026. More important, Charlemagne's new deal will help him expand his Black Effect podcast network, a joint venture with iHeartMedia. Quote, when I was looking at doing my new deal with iHeartMedia, close quote, Charlemagne says, quote, I was like, I don't want to be just talent. I want to create this podcast network. I want to create the BET, Black Entertainment Television, for podcasting, close quote. Since 2020, Black Effect has launched more than 60 shows, including with former NBA stars Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson, and entrepreneurs Damon John and John Hope Bryant, becoming a vital large part of iHeartMedia's revenue stream. iHeartMedia reported podcast revenue of $448.8 million in 2024, up from $252.6 million in 2021 and $101.7 million the year prior. Charlemagne says he wants to add 10 more shows in 2026. Quote, I want to create 100 versions of me, close quote, he says. Charlemagne looks at what Oprah and Tyler Perry have built with their own studios. He also takes inspiration from Ryan Seacrest, who started as a radio host before becoming ubiquitous on television and transforming himself into a powerful TV producer, most notably as the force behind the Kardashians. Quote, Charlemagne, Pittman says, is on that course more than others, and there's just not many of them that come along like that, close quote. Like all great comic book heroes, Charlemagne has an origin story. The son of an English teacher and construction worker, he was raised in Monk's Corner, South Carolina. He developed a passion for collecting comics and often reimagined superheroes into more relatable figures. Quote, I had a Captain America who was Captain Africa, close quote, he recalls. Quote, I had a Black Wolverine, and then we started learning about Luke Cage's of the world, close quote. But those superheroes wouldn't shield him from life's villains. At age 8, he was sexually molested by a family member. Today, he uses the trauma to discuss his mental health journey. By 17, he found himself expelled from 2 high schools, abusing alcohol and selling drugs. To conceal his identity on the street, he renamed himself quote-unquote Charlie, taking his inspiration from the stories of Charlemagne, the 9th century Holy Roman Emperor, and Charlemagne Peralta, the early 20th century Haitian leader who opposed U.S. occupation of his country. Still, the street lifestyle led to trouble, including a 45-day jail sentence following a shooting incident. Months later, he was arrested again during a drug bust. Sitting in jail a second time, he recalls, quote, was the beginning of the change, close quote. As a young radio assistant at Charleston Z93, he dreamed of becoming a national media personality along the lines of 2 of his inspirations, late-night talk show host Arsenio Hall and BET host Petey Green. That led to a stint at Hot 103.9 in nearby Columbia before he took a job in 2006 as Wendy Williams' sidekick on WBLS in New York. That's when Charlemagne learned to play the villain. Quote, Wendy used to treat me like an attack dog, close quote, he says. The national attention paid off. 2 years later, he began working as a radio host at 100.3 The Beat in Philadelphia before joining The Breakfast Club on New York's Power 105.1. Today, the show is a top 50 podcast with distribution across iHeartMedia, Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. Quote, I didn't just get here, close quote, Charlemagne says. Quote, I took the stairs, but I want people to know about the journey of how I got here. me becoming the best version of myself, investing in my mental health in a real way. That's what you're seeing now, close quote. Beyond growing the Black Effect Network, Charlemagne has bigger ambitions to go with his newfound wealth. He's the co-founder of SBH Productions with comedian Kevin Hart and the author of three books. He also launched Black Privilege, a book imprint with Simon & Schuster. In 2024, he also opened his first of six Crystal franchises in South Carolina. And yes, he dreams of launching a comic book line. He even has plans to develop a character in his image with godlike powers. He has already released a five-part comic series, The Illuminati, in partnership with AWA Studios. The goal is to create a new generation of black characters. Quote, it's time for a new era of comics, close quote, he says. Moving now to Barron's. The biggest threats to wealth aren't necessarily bad investments. The underappreciated risks to your nest egg. Financial advisors spend hours planning for their clients' investment growth, maximizing returns, minimizing costs, and fine-tuning portfolios for every market turn. But the biggest threats to financial success aren't always in the investment account. They're the quieter risks lurking in less glamorous areas, such as budgeting and tax and estate planning. We ask advisors to name the underappreciated risks that could derail clients' long-term success and how they help families confront them. Laura Combs, Executive Managing Partner, Head of Women and Wealth at Mercer Advisors. More and more wealth is moving to people who have not been the primary wealth management clients. We're seeing a massive structural change where wealth is moving more and more to women through inheritance, divorce, longevity, entrepreneurship. Historically, the wealth management industry has been built primarily with male decision makers. The overlooked risk is that the person who ultimately will control the wealth hasn't been deeply engaged in the plan. And when a transition happens, you suddenly have different decision makers who haven't been involved. Let's talk about divorce. Advisors might treat it as a legal event, when in reality, it's one of the most complex financial restructuring events that a family will experience. Without planning, there's a significant risk that families can lose a significant amount of wealth. If women in particular have not been involved in the decision-making, they don't have the context necessarily to be making those decisions. Jumping in later does hold a pretty big financial risk to them. And then moving on to Cameron Rogers, financial advisor for Angelus Wealth. There's an increasing risk from both longevity and dependency. We all plan for retirement, but the unknown is who depends on us, on both sides of our generation. With my clients, you're seeing parents who are aging and needing care and additional support, often at the same time that adult children are financially dependent or not fully launched. That's a tough situation because the vast majority of retirees will need long-term care at some point. And very little planning truly accounts for the extent of that. You have to build in negative assumptions. And that's hard because everyone wants to assume that everything's going to be okay. If you build in a hard situation or an outsized expense and it has a meaningful impact, that's hard news to deliver. But it's our job to deliver it. I think there's also a sort of false simplicity in assumptions around estate planning. People go through estate planning and setting up various trusts to avoid probate, and they almost take that first action as being all set. I've noticed that the actual administration of the estate and getting that team right is just as important. It's the actual team around the administration that could eventually be identifying and logging the transfer of ownership and assets. The last thing I see today is general concentration risk. I think there's an assumption that there will always be an end buyer for things, and so people will become over-concentrated in certain assets, assuming that's going to happen. I do think that's a risk that we're just not talking about. This next is by Stephen Harp, financial advisor for Savvy Advisors. We've done a lot of deep dive comprehensive planning in the past couple of years, and one huge theme has been taxes. Whether it's a lack of tax diversification, too much pre-tax and not enough Roth, or maybe even not enough after-tax or liquid investments. We went as far as bringing a CPA into our firm last year because tax planning has become the number one most important thing to our practice. I think all of our clients realize taxes are important. Everyone understands that there are probably some inefficiencies in their situation, but when we pull back the curtain and illustrate that for them via comprehensive planning, it takes it to a whole other level. I use the quippy maxim that the markets will go up and they will go down. You won't lose anything if you just stick to the principles and don't sell in a bad market. There's no loss of capital just by being invested. But with taxes every year, you have a permanent loss of capital. So by managing that aspect of your financial plan, you are more certain of favorable results. An example of a strategy we use for our clients with large taxable investment accounts is tax managing with custom or direct indexing. So instead of holding ETFs, where you have almost no control over gains and losses and dividends that spit out, we're actually mirroring that with an index of directly held stocks. So we can go in and cherry-pick losses to realize from a tax benefit perspective. Next up, Kyle Akers, Senior Advisor for Modern Wealth Management. A lot of times, ultra-wealthy households are building their empire, or if you will, their portfolio. They want it to reach as far down generations as it possibly can. How do we make sure that the dollars go to who we want, when we want, and keep the bad actors out of the picture? The risk is that the dollars aren't going to who you want, when you want, how you want. Estate planning is something that people think can always be done tomorrow. It's expensive, and it's not necessarily benefiting you as mom and dad or the grantors. So it's easy to procrastinate, especially if you haven't put together a team that is acting in conjunction with one another. But there are things that have to be done before your demise that can't be corrected after the fact. And it's something that, if done correctly, holy smokes, you feel a little bit invincible. Continuing in Barron's, Oracle's new CFO comes from the power industry. That tells you everything. This is by Adam Levine. This week, Oracle announced the hiring of a new chief financial officer, Hillary Maxson. This wouldn't be that notable were it not for the dramatic transition happening at Oracle as it adds a rapidly growing cloud computing unit to its software offerings. Maxson was brought in to manage Oracle's accelerating fundraising and spending for artificial intelligence. Maxson isn't the usual candidate for the CFO of a software and cloud services company like Oracle. She comes from Schneider Electric, a manufacturer of industrial electrical equipment, including for power plants and data centers. Before that, she was with AES, a power generator. In the company's press release announcing the hire, Oracle co-CEO Clay Magurek said that she was being brought in for her, quote, experience scaling capital-intensive global organizations, close quote. Quote, Hillary's experience spans industrial, infrastructure, and software businesses, sectors where capital intensity and execution excellence are critical to success, close quote, Magurek said. Her hiring emphasizes how important acquiring power, land, and buildings for AI data centers have become and how crucial financing is now. Safra Catz was CFO and had remained Oracle's principal financial officer even after she was elevated to co-CEO in 2014. Last year, she left both posts to become executive vice chairman of the board, and executive vice president Doug Kearing had filled the finance role until Maxson's hire. Magurek mentioned quote-unquote capital intensity twice in his statement because in 2026, that is the name of the game at Oracle. Fueled by artificial intelligence demand and a $553 billion multi-year backlog, Oracle is rapidly building AI data centers in its Oracle Cloud Infrastructure unit that rents out servers over the internet. In the past 12 months, Oracle has spent $48 billion on capital expenditures and has told investors to expect $50 billion in 2026. While Oracle still has substantial operational cash flow, it's being swallowed up by all the CapEx. Oracle has had to dip into financing markets, including a $25 billion February debt sale that followed an $18 billion in September offering. At $136 billion, Oracle's debt load has risen $42 billion in just 9 months. Oracle also sold convertible preferred stock in February and has registered to sell equity shares. Maxson's hire echoes one at Meta earlier in the year. Meta may spend up to $135 billion on CapEx this year, and the company hired a banker with extensive international experience, Dina Powell McCormick, as its president. Both she and Maxson are being brought in at a time when financing has become as important as operations for these two companies, something that hasn't been true of either for decades. For Oracle, operations are also being disrupted by AI. There have been widespread reports of up to 30,000 layoffs at Oracle beginning at the end of March. Some of Oracle's 2026 CapEx is going to come from payroll savings, and the company is, in effect, trading people for computers. This will be the first major test case of how well AI can improve productivity at this relatively early stage. Can Oracle continue its accelerating growth even as it lays off anywhere from 10% to 25% of its workforce? If it can, a lot more tech layoffs may follow. Continuing in Barron's, oil shock could push March inflation well above 3%, and it may not stop there. This is written by Megan Leonhardt. There's little doubt that the recent spike in gasoline prices will drive up inflation readings starting with the March data, set to be released on Friday. But the details in the data could create major headaches for Federal Reserve officials grappling with persistently elevated price growth. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is scheduled to publish the March Consumer Price Index at 8:30 a.m. The data is set to provide the first comprehensive look at the magnitude and speed at which the Iran war has taken a toll on U.S. price levels. Yet even before the start of the war, economic data had been pointing to mounting inflationary pressures, and investors should watch Friday's data to determine whether that persists. If the rise in inflation extends beyond simply higher gasoline prices, it could signal that the Fed will need to step in. Economists, nonetheless, expect the penalty of higher oil prices to provide the biggest boost to last month's inflation measure. Headline CPI inflation is expected to have climbed 0.9% on the month, lifting price growth to 3.4% year over year in March, according to FactSet. The Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, however, is estimating a slightly smaller gain of 3.25% year over year in March. Still, across the board, estimates call for a sharp jump after months of softer readings. For context, headline inflation advanced just 0.2% in February, translating to a gain of 2.4% year over year. Bank of America economist Stephen Juneau expects Friday's data to show a 10.6% month-over-month jump in energy prices from the Iran war. Gasoline prices have been on a tear since the start of the war on February 28th, rising by 20% by mid-March, during the week that the Bureau collects inflation data, according to data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Fed policymakers have indicated that they could look through some of the inflationary effects from the oil shock if they prove to be short-term. But with inflation running above the Fed's 2% target for 5 years, there could be less latitude to simply wait and see. The March CPI data is unlikely to push the Fed into action, but it is expected to show that inflation is the mounting problem for policymakers, even as labor conditions remain stalled and economic growth is under pressure. Beyond the projected surge in the overall energy index, investors should watch the food index in Friday's headline data. Overall food prices ticked up from January to February, and that momentum is expected to continue in March. The Department of Agriculture's index of prices paid remained firm in February, signaling that consumers likely saw little relief on groceries or dining out. Looking ahead, the longer oil prices remain high, the more it will weigh on transport costs and fertilizer prices, potentially pushing food costs higher. Core inflation, which excludes the more volatile food and energy prices and is considered a better determinant of long-run trends, is expected to be more muted for March, though still exhibiting some upward momentum. Economists surveyed by FactSet collectively expect core CPI to rise by 0.3%, translating to a 2.7% annual gain. That's up from February's 0.2% monthly pace and the 2.5% year-over-year advance. But economists warn that if the core expectations prove accurate, the core index is still trending above levels typically consistent with the Fed's 2% target, and that's before most of the effect of the Iran war, both direct and indirect, show up in core data. Still, it's worth watching airfares and delivery services price data on Friday for early signs of higher oil prices seeping through to the broader economy. Quote, a key determinant of how high core inflation will go this month will be the extent to which airlines and other oil-consuming companies have raised the prices for their services slash goods to offset the higher energy costs, close quote, writes Bei-Chen Lin, senior investment strategist at Russell Investments. March's firmer core print is expected to be driven in part by a 1% increase in used car prices, which is unrelated to rising energy costs. Used vehicles prices have been rising in recent months, driven by higher demand as consumers use higher tax refunds to fund purchases. The Manheim Used Vehicle Value Index rose 6.2% year over year in March, for example, hitting its highest reading since the summer of 2023. New car prices, however, are expected to remain unchanged in March. Tariffs are expected to modestly boost monthly inflation in March, as well as for the next few months, according to Goldman Sachs economists Jessica Rindels and Ronnie Walker. For March, they expect this to add about 0.03 percentage points to inflation, particularly in sections that rely on imports, such as recreational goods. Still, even with these concerning developments, most economists and Fed watchers expect policymakers to hold interest rates steady at the upcoming April 28, 29 meeting. The minutes from the March meeting, published Wednesday, carried a hawkish tone, but neither closed the door on easing nor ruled out tightening instead until officials know whether the inflationary effects of the Iran war will be contained or broad-based. The central bank seems to be stuck in a holding pattern. Quote, from the Federal Reserve's perspective, we believe these upside inflation risks support a wait-and-see approach to any additional interest rate cuts, close quote, writes Brock Weimer, investment strategy analyst at Edward Jones. Moving now to Fortune magazine, AI is changing the CEO's role and could lead to a changing of the guard, by Phil Waba. When Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella told employees in October that he was giving up running the tech company's commercial businesses, he said that he was doing so to increase his focus on Microsoft's technology work and very specifically on AI. Nadella explained that Microsoft's continued success would depend on equipping customers with new artificial intelligence capabilities to make it, quote, the partner of choice for AI transformation, close quote. With that act, the 58-year-old Microsoft chief, whose 12 years in the corner office are an eternity by Fortune 500 standards, was telegraphing that mystery of AI was non-negotiable. During Nadella's extremely successful run, shares have risen 11-fold, and Microsoft has joined the very tiny club of companies with valuation above $3 trillion. But he won't remain relevant or effective if he doesn't stay on top of AI and how it's changing his industry, and neither, for that matter, will his peers in any industry. This new reality is taking shape as several of the most high-profile Silicon Valley CEOs are extending their tenures into their second decades. They include 53-year-old Sundar Pichai, 10 years at Google, 6 heading its more recently formed parent Alphabet, and Apple's 65-year-old Tim Cook, 14 years as CEO. It's becoming clear that AI will play a major role in how much longer these CEOs remain at the top. But elsewhere in tech and across the Fortune 500, such long tenures will likely become increasingly rare, at least during the first waves of the AI boom. Indeed, the numbers are already beginning to shrink. The average global CEO tenure has declined to 7.2 years, below the highs of 8.4 years recorded in 2021 and 2023, according to leadership advisory firm Russell Reynolds. Tech CEO tenures are roughly in line with the cross-industry average, and that figure will likely to continue to drift downward for a few years. The firm surmises that that's because boards are closely monitoring CEO effectiveness and whether they respond to change with precision and adaptability, considerations AI is bringing to the fore. And those boards are quick to act if performance lags. In addition to generating more churn, wider adoption of AI may also shake up the demographics of the CEO pool. Industry observers expect the next wave of CEOs to skew younger as boards seek leaders who are fluent in AI. And CEOs may also need youth, or at least youthfulness, to help stave off burnout as AI generates a faster rate of change inside their companies. Quote, between the compression of the disruption cycle and the risk that's inherent, boards' expectations for CEOs are that you've got to be an AI native, close quote, says Chad Hesters, CEO of executive search firm Boyden. Quote, you've got to understand this stuff, and you've got to understand it's not a gradual shift, close quote. It's certainly not coincidental that longevity and AI success have gone hand in hand in big tech. Nadella, who comes from a product background, is blazing a trail and showing other longtime CEOs How to Acknowledge and Approach the Rise of AI, Microsoft's Early Investment in OpenAI, and its integration of ChatGPT with its Azure cloud business are hallmarks of his tenure. Pache, meanwhile, has turned Google from a laggard in generative AI to a major threat to ChatGPT by OpenAI CEO Sam Altman's own admission. Pache has committed the company to an AI-first strategy, placing machine learning at the center of Google's products, research, and infrastructure, and making sure AI is never an afterthought. As for Apple, many critics say that under Cook, it has fallen behind in the AI race. Several senior leaders left the company in the fourth quarter of 2025, and there is considerable speculation that Cook may be preparing to step aside. Apple has declined to comment on reports about that speculation. Though elder statesmen by the relatively youthful standards of tech, Nadella and Pache have figured out how to navigate a technology that is changing how business operates. It's not about pure AI skills a computer scientist might possess, but rather about AI savvy and understanding how AI can help them and the companies they lead to compete. After all, a tech CEO's job is almost never focused on coding and the technical minutiae of AI, or of any other tech for that matter, but instead on taking the big picture view and designing and implementing strategy. The job also calls for the perspective that comes with experience. The better to understand the nuances and the changes that AI may bring about in other elements of a business, such as data privacy and security. Still, the urgency of CEOs needing AI-oriented sensibilities is hardly limited to tech companies. Indeed, every industry stands to be transformed by AI. In retail, AI will radically change business pillars like customer surveys and inventory management, while airlines will use it for such crucial tasks as optimal rescheduling of flights in case of a dramatic snowstorm or predicting airplane component failures. When Walmart and Target each recently introduced new CEOs, John Furner and Michael Fedecky, respectively, both retailers touted the incoming chief's ease with AI, a technology that is already changing how their customers shop. Walmart recently moved its stock listing from NYSE to NASDAQ to make its tech focus unmistakable. Over in aviation, Delta Airlines' Ed Bastian earlier this year unveiled a generative AI travel assistant, while United Airlines' Scott Kirby claimed in June that his airline is, quote, probably doing more AI than anyone, close quote. Companies certainly believe that investors care. A FactSet report in December found that during the most recent quarterly earnings season, the term AI was cited on 306 earnings calls conducted by S&P 500 companies, well above the five-year average of 136. That said, older tech and legacy industry CEOs don't necessarily need to fret if they lack the time or the aptitude to become AI insiders. They can survive and even thrive in the AI wave, provided they show intellectual curiosity and adaptability, says Jason Baumgarten, partner at leadership advisory firm Spencer Stuart, who helps train CEOs and advises boards. Quote, what we are seeing across the board is a desire for CEOs who bring more of a beginner's mind and adaptability and not a rigorous pushback to, quote, how it used to be, close quote, Baumgarten says. More than ever, CEOs need to be thinking ahead to what their industry and their clients' needs will look like in the very long term. Quote, you can't just CEO your way through this and just delegate this, close quote, says Fawad Bawa, Global AI Analytics and Data Practice Lead for Russell Reynolds. Quote, you need to take charge of what this means in terms of the possibilities and constraints and the potential risks, close quote. In an echo of the froth of the 1990s when people understood the internet would dramatically change life but didn't quite know how or how quickly, near-term anticipation has possibly outstripped the reality of what AI will ultimately deliver. Certainly, the stock market has been bumpy lately as investors try to figure out whether companies are spending too much on AI in the short run. So CEOs will have to guard against getting carried away by the hype and avoid making bets on initiatives whose utility isn't relatively clear. Quote, you're going to be held accountable for delivering a ROI, close quote, says Boyden's Hesters. That's proved difficult so far. Indeed, the growing complexity of figuring out where AI can make an impact has helped fuel a recent uptick in the number of companies choosing co-CEO arrangements, says Christine Barton, a managing director and senior partner at Boston Consulting Group, who leads its North American CEO advisory practice. Quote, "It's a very tough set of skills to have in one individual," close quote, Barton says. Quote, "Even if individuals have mastered the ability to blend those skills, are they really optimizing these very different parts of the brain?" Close quote. In a related development, more companies have made their CTOs and CIOs more central to devising overall corporate strategy with the rest of the C-suite. It's not only Fortune 500 CEOs who will have to show ease and dexterity in the face of the AI revolution. Jeff Clavier, co-founder and board member of venture capital firm Uncork Capital, says he asks the CEOs of his portfolio startups to imagine what the fully AI-enabled vision of their company and industry would look like, because he tells them for each of their companies, there are another 10 startups that are gearing up for AI. Quote, "The key characteristic for CEOs in an AI world is the ability to accept that fundamental changes will happen way, way faster than typical innovation curves," close quote, Clavier says. He points to how ChatGPT, at just over 3 years of age, has changed so much. "Every leader will have to accept the possibility that they may have to completely reinvent their business in short order and regularly in the AI era," in other words, to channel their inner Satya Nadella. Continuing in Fortune, results and reputations on the move. Highlights from this year's survey. Toyota steers through rough terrain. Economic uncertainty and inflation made 2025 a tough year for new car sales, but Toyota Motor, the top-ranked Asian company on our all-star list, rode out the slump to emerge as the world's top seller by market share. Toyota's oft-criticized electric vehicle strategy, focusing on gas-electric hybrids rather than on pure battery EVs, looked prescient as the U.S., the European Union, and China phased out or reduced EV subsidies. In the U.S., its 2025 sales were on track to rise 8% year-over-year, despite the imposition of new tariffs on many of its models by the Trump administration. Toyota's 2026 plans include innovations at both ends of the price spectrum, among them a $15,000 electric SUV aimed at China's market, and a global expansion of its ultra-luxury Century Mark, which previously sold only in Japan. Next up, a mid-air milestone for Airbus. In October, Airbus finally won bragging rights in a four-decade battle with dual-ply rival Boeing. Its A320 narrow-body passenger jet, which entered service in 1988, surpassed Boeing's 737 in total deliveries to airlines, with more than 12,260 aircraft deployed. The milestone reflects Airbus's long-standing strategy of catering to low-cost carriers. It also reflects extensive production delays at Boeing after two fatal crashes involving the 737 MAX. Both manufacturers have been slow to bring a next-generation passenger jet to market, but in recent years, customers and investors have placed more trust in the Netherlands-based Airbus. The company, which was on track to bring in 75 billion euros in revenue for 2025, makes its debut this year on our all-star list. Continuing on the all-star list, roundup, a tumble at Target. One iconic American retailer took a reputational tumble this year. Target, ranked number 27 in 2025, has fallen off the top 50, breaking a 24-year streak on our all-star list. As of early January, Target was tracking toward a third straight fiscal year of declining revenue, and its stock was down more than 60% from its 2021 peak. Among the factors hurting the cheap chic giant, slip-ups in inventory management and customer service, as well as wrath from activists on the left and right alike over its flip-flopping diversity policies. Insiders and investors hope that a change at the top will revitalize Target. COO Michael Fiddelke will succeed Brian Cornwell as CEO in February. Next up, companies are inundating customers with surveys and getting worse results, by Phil Waba. 1 week last autumn, I hit my customer feedback limit. I had seen my doctor and done some online shopping. I went on a vacation to Europe that involved 3 airlines and 3 hotel stays. At every turn, I was bombarded with dozens of email requests for feedback, often multiple times from the same company about the same interaction. Quote, how did we do? Close quote. How was registration? Close quote. Rate your doctor. Tell us about your flight. What did you think of our meal offerings in the Terminal 4 lounge? How was your hotel check-in? Close quote. And this doesn't include the little four facial expression thingamajigs in airport restrooms that ask you to rank cleanliness by touching them. Enough. Americans have long been bombarded by customer experience surveys, but if you feel that it has gotten worse, much worse, it's not your imagination. Qualtrics, a software company that helps organizations collect feedback, said in October that the total number of customer and employee interactions processed on its platform has doubled since 2023, and that it now captures and analyzes more than 3.5 billion conversations and interactions annually. That includes surveys, but also call center conversations, chat logs, survey responses, social media posts, and product reviews. U.S. spending on market research has been rising almost 4% annually, according to research from IBISWorld, to an estimated $36 billion last year. Quote, survey fatigue is real, close quote, says Brad Anderson, president of products, user experience, and engineering at Qualtrics. He acknowledged that many emailed survey requests have devolved into spam. Quote, it's things like the same brand bombarding an individual over and over again, close quote. And even as the common consumer becomes increasingly exasperated by the endless stream of feedback request emails, marketing experts say they don't even work particularly well. Quote, if only all of this email besiegement was leading to meaningful insights, close quotes, is Peter Fader, a professor at the Wharton School and an expert in customer analytics, quote, but it rarely does, close quote. For one thing, surveys tend to over-index for rants and raves. Some people get so exasperated with their interaction or with the persistent nagging emails that they might answer in an angry way. Conversely, when consumers are happy with their product or service, they are far likelier to want to fill out a survey to give credit where it's due. But the large swath of views between those strong opinions is much harder to capture. Quote, you're getting a very biased view, simply because there's survey overload, close quote, says New York University marketing professor Priya Raghubir. Many surveys take a one-size-fits-all approach, says Qualtrics Anderson. If a survey doesn't zero in on a customer's particular experience or reflect whether the customer has been surveyed before, Anderson asks, quote, why should they take the time to fill out the survey, close quote. This is where AI could make a difference, he noted. He sees a future in which surveys allow for more qualitative opinions and redirect feedback that is irrelevant or minor. AI already allows brands to integrate insights from calls, chats, reviews, and that companies already have, says Columbia Business School professor Vicky Morowitz. The surveys companies send to consumers look increasingly outdated. Quote, they could answer their questions, close quote, she says, quote, without having to ask us, close quote. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.